Keep it right here for City Visions on KALW San Francisco 91.7 FL.
Good evening and welcome to City Vision. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. 6 weeks after the murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police, protests for racial justice continue across the country and around the Bay Area, both by the numbers of those who have stepped out onto the streets and in the diversity of protesters who've made their voices heard. This continues to be an unprecedented time in our country. San Francisco Supervisor Shamon Walton is a case in point about local officials who are responding to the call to change the systemic racism in our institutions. He's proposed several new pieces of legislation to address systemic racism and police brutality in San Francisco, and tonight we'll hear more about his initiatives. Then we get a response from San Francisco Chronicle columnist Otis R. Taylor Jr. and Mission Local Managing Editor Joe Eskenazi. And finally, we wrap up with a conversation with Paula West, the iconic Bay Area jazz and cabaret singer. But first, Dr. Bob Wachter, the chair of UCSF's Department of Medicine, declared last week that, quote, the miracle is over. Until recently, California had a recent relatively low number of coronavirus cases and deaths when compared with many other parts of the country, but no longer. Case numbers and hospitalizations have soared in recent weeks, causing concern that our state's luck has run out. Here to help us understand the latest coronavirus news and trends, I'm pleased to be joined again by Erin Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back, Erin.
Thanks for having me again.
And Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious diseases specialist at UCSF. Welcome, Peter.
Hola, Pache.
So it's been a couple of weeks since we last had you on the show, and I'd love to start by asking each of you to give us a rundown of the biggest developments since we last met. So, Erin, let's start with you.
Well, I think the obvious answer to that is, just what's happening in California and even in the Bay Area with this, we thought we were in pretty good shape. And then it seemed like out of nowhere, we weren't. And first we saw these really big cases come up. I mean, for us at the Chronicle, just one day it sort of came up that there were 6,000 cases in California, and then we did it again. And then it was 8,000 cases. And it's just like, where did this come from? And then the Bay Area started, kind of tagging along, was a couple of days behind, but suddenly we saw our numbers creeping up, and now the hospital numbers are really climbing up pretty quickly. And, it's pointed out, and it's worth noting that our capacity is still in pretty good shape. Most of our hospitals in the Bay Area have lots of room still, but it's not good looking at the charts. In fact, I have them up on my computer right now, and it's disappointing. I think when I first saw those cases come out, I just kind of, my stomach dropped. It felt like we were in really good shape. Like, we'd done everything right, everybody was saying, or not everything. I mean, certainly we had some missteps, but for the most part, we'd done about as good as anybody can do in the United States. And here we are again.
Right. So hospitalizations up 50% in the last 2 weeks. This is the 15th straight day of record new cases in California. The positive rate of results from tests is up to over 7% in the last 7 days. ICU admissions up 39%. Oh boy, what happened, Peter Chin Hong?
So don't you want me to give my top five first? But we can just go to what happened. I was just looking forward to doing my top five. Actually, I made a top 10 list, but I knew Erin was going to.
All right, That's true. That's true. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got excited there. Go ahead. Do your top 10.
Well, I'll do my top five for the interest of time.
Okay.
So my top five things are, first of all, we're not only not a miracle California at this moment. I would say that we're in Chernobyl COVID because of what's happening in San Quentin with, almost 1,400 inmates positive for COVID and a disaster. So that's the number one headline. Number two for me is a kind of optimistic thing, although I'm worried about it. The schedule for Major League Baseball was talked about today, where they have a very ambitious testing schedule to keep the players safe. Of course, no fans, but they're hoping to do something like 14,000 tests a week, which a small country would have problems with. So I'm hoping that they can pull it off. Again, baseball means so much to America. Number three, on the other end of safety, the Indy 500 in Indianapolis, they're planning to do that in August, and they're hoping to bring 175,000 people together, and masks are not going to be mandatory. So I'm scared about that on the other end. My number four headline is around masking. We can talk for hours about that and the politics. And Toronto is giving a million free masks to their public transit riders with a focus on vulnerable patients. So I thought that was a great model. And finally, my number five headline is around travel and the bans. And it's kind of scary to come to be banned from going to New York right now from California.
And to Europe and where
else? Europe and to Hawaii.
I think Canada too, right?
Yeah, maybe Aaron might know about Canada.
I think we have been from Canada for a while now.
Yeah. Wow.
I shouldn't laugh, but it's ridiculous.
I think I'm laughing because everyone wants to move to Canada, but.
Nope. I mean, I think you maybe can go, but have to be quarantined for 2 weeks. So.
Right. So before I jumped to ask you what happened here, Peter, I remember talking to the both of you 2 weeks ago and I said, should be we worried? And you're like, nah, it's going to be fine. And then it wasn't. What happened?
I know. And I'm such an eternal optimist and I'll be interested to hear Aaron's perspective around this. But I think we got tired, you know, and history repeats itself. In 1918, when you look at the history, San Franciscans had masks throwing away parties. They threw masks in the air. There were like famous pictures of that being done. You know, we were good for so long and there's only so much. And there was increasing distance between what public health was saying and what the people wanted to do. And there were even death threats against public health officials who wanted to do community masking.
You're talking about 1918. You're not talking
about 1918.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Just to
and
be
then,
clear.
But now too, yeah, there are death threats against Orange County. And Aaron could probably amplify this about public health officials talking about masking. And then finally, I think there is such a patchwork of reopening. And we've talked about this on the show before. It's confusing for people and it's hard to know where to go to do what. And you need to look on a website to figure it out. So I think people were confused. And, you know, a lot of people were having graduation parties indoors. So things that were not visible, which were like the beaches and the bars. But a lot of stuff was happening on the inside as well.
I was just listening to the lead-in, the Daily from the New York Times before we went to air. And the reporter that was talking to Michael Barbaro was saying that the protests really did not cause this surge. Do you agree with that, Peter?
Look at New York, for example, where there are tons of protests and their numbers have been relatively flat. So I think the independent effect of protests were probably not significant if you account for mask wearing. So like we talked about it before in the show, but you know, when I looked around at San Francisco protesters, people like 70 to 80% of people were wearing masks. And I'm not sure about New York, but I hear that a similar number of people were also. So I think, you know, that independent effect of protests outside, people were responsible, you know, is probably not as big as people had feared.
And how about the relaxing of guidelines? Of restrictions, Aaron, meaning being able to eat outdoors again. How much are people worried that that is contributing to this? And if so, why aren't we rolling back to where we were before that?
Well, I think to my mind, I mean, certainly that is a factor. I think a lot of this gets really muddy because you factor in the protests and Memorial Day and Mother's Day and graduation parties and the reopening and all that happening at the same time, right? So it's like you kind of get this vibe, I think, of just people sort of almost being given permission to relax a little bit, yeah, to be told you can go out and do these things. And like, well, if I can go and expand my social bubble and if I can go to an outdoor restaurant, I can probably go to a Mother's Day gathering and just, you know, be careful. And maybe I'll just hug mom for a second instead of, you know what I mean? So there's just sort of, I think, a lot of factors that come into play all at once that kind of lead to this mentality. So, I mean, I'm sort of a little hesitant to kind of play that blame game and say that people are just misbehaving wildly. I think that there's certainly some of that going on, but I feel like in California, people want to be responsible, but we're just getting so many mixed messages and it's also hard. Like this stuff is really hard. And I say that as somebody who, I went to visit my parents a couple of weeks ago and we got tested. I got tested before I went. I tested negative. I feel like I was responsible, but you know, that was a decision I made. And I think what we're seeing, and I talked to Dr. Wachter last week for a story, and he kind of put it as you're counting on 40 million in California, 40 million people making 100 decisions every day to do the right thing. And is it really that surprising that we're going to have a misstep? And I think one thing that I'm hearing from folks is what we're seeing in the Bay Area is sort of a controlled misstep. So we're still in a situation where we can kind of wrestle this back into shape. And it's not, we haven't spiraled. We're not going to see that exponential growth unless we just go wild, which we're not. So we can get this thing manageable. The rest of California, especially Southern California, LA, Imperial County, God forbid, like that's going to be harder. I think it sort of remains to be seen if they get their act together, if they're going to be able to really get their numbers back down. But I do feel like we can still get there in the Bay Area.
It reminds me of our governor's metaphor of the dimmer switch, right? That we're it's not an on off, it's a dimmer switch. But I feel like the dimmer switch metaphor is falling apart a little bit because it's not as controlled.
Well, I think it's like they let the toddler in and just like swiped it up. I mean, they just kind of like let it go.
Or there's multiple switches and they were all sort of slightly inched up. And when you put those together, it goes out of control.
It's like that goes into that kind of muddy. Yeah, go on.
Oh, sorry. It's like when you go to Safeway, you try to get that three-way switch for your lamp and you bought the wrong one and it's just like an on and off switch. So like you don't have that control on the different levels of light.
So one thing I want to go back to, Peter, is there a silver lining here that we're not seeing an increases in deaths? Is that because it's too early or because who's getting sick or what?
I mean, I always remember something that Erin said like maybe a couple of shows ago that really made me think, you know. She said, when somebody's asking, she said, hey, we've learned a lot since end of February, early March and about COVID and how to take care of patients. And we have investigational drugs now. We have drugs that are close to FDA clearance, you know, remdesivir. We have steroids that have mortality benefit. We have convalescent plasma. We know how to take care of patients better in the ICU. So we've come a long way. So even with a large number of cases, independent of who's getting sick, I think we are going to do a better job if we don't get overrun with cases like New York did, which I don't think we will, hopefully. Like Erin was saying, I think we're in control, hopefully right now, and we can do something. And the people of California have risen to the occasion before, and I believe we'll also do that at this point. So, you know, younger people for sure, but they can still get sick. And the other thing I'm worried about is that it's a stacked phenomenon in the hospital, right? People with COVID don't get over like community-acquired pneumonia in 3 days and they're out. They're there for like 3 weeks. So the more people you let in, the older people, the people who've been hospitalized longer, aren't necessarily leaving.
Right. So that just, clogs things up pretty much. You mentioned some of the drugs there, like remdesivir, and then the other treatments like convalescent plasma. So remdesivir, it looks like the 5-day course is going to be about $3,000. There's been some talk, but not a lot of attention paid to, you know, teaching an old medicine new tricks, as you used to say 3 months ago, Peter. Dexamethasone, a steroid, an immune suppressant. Where is that in all of this? And I'm assuming it's a lot cheaper than $3,000.
Yeah, it's like $5 or $3, depending on who you look at or what, if you get generic versus name brand dexamethasone.
So how are you choosing between the two?
I mean, it's, you know, some people are being conservative by wanting to wait till the peer-reviewed publication comes out. Others, I think for sheer necessity and not having enough remdesivir, are jumping on the bandwagon, which I think most ID docs believe in the data. There's other data in early ARDS or acute lung injury where steroids might have a role and some societies have actually changed their guidelines. So I think it's a thing, but again, it's part of the picture, right? You treat the virus and you treat the inflammation, and the holy grail or the sweet spot is really using both. So they each tell a part of the story.
So you definitely still sound optimistic because even though there's a surge in cases, you feel like there's a lot more that we know at this point that is making the medical community savvier in how to approach the cases that are coming into the hospital.
Yeah, the only thing that we don't have necessarily, and I don't mean to be glib by this, is saying that, you know, it's the energy and the, you know, the sustenance we need in the medical field. I mean, we talk about people in the community having to have resolve to stay in it all together for all these months. I would say on the medical front, people are tired. You know, we thought we'd be over with this. We thought we'd be moving on to our quote unquote regular life. And we're not able to do that anymore.
Aaron, I wanted to turn to some of the counties in the Bay Area that are not doing so well. You mentioned Southern California as a big hotspot, including Imperial County. But here locally, it's Contra Costa, Solano, Santa Clara County. They're on the watch list.
That thing changes all the time.
So are they still on the watch list?
Santa Clara got dropped off of it today. Contra Costa got dropped over the weekend, was added on today. Santa Clara got dropped today. Marin County was added. It seriously is like, it's so hard to keep on top of. But
so,
yes.
So what is this watch list and what is it telling us about, you know, to use a term from our climate, micro pandemics within the Bay Area?
I think that the reason why, I mean, I kind of laugh obviously about the sort of, you know, musical chairs of counties, at least in the Bay Area, getting on and off of the watch list. But that's actually, it's kind of a good sign, because what I think this thing is meant to do is, so the state has picked these markers, these sort of metrics that they're going to keep tabs of. And if these counties sort of miss their metrics for a period of time, they get on this watch list. So it's sort of like raising a red flag saying, hey, you might be in trouble. Let's talk it out. Let's get into some details about what's going on. And what I like about it as a journalist and just as a person of the public is that they have a little, you know, analysis of why they're on the watch list. So for Marin County, for example, they're on there because of San Quentin and because of the pressure that's already kind of putting on their hospitals or starting to put on their hospitals. It's starting to increase their case rates. So that makes sense. You know, I think both Santa Clara County and Contra Costa County were also on there for just kind of upticks that were a little concerning with their hospitals, but they both got that kind of wrestled that under control pretty quickly. So it's, but they tell you, you know, where they're seeing the cases, you know, are we looking, are these in skilled nursing facilities? Are they in homeless shelters? Are they from community transmission from essential workers? They kind of give you a sense of what's going on, which I like. I like kind of knowing what are the trouble spots and that the counties are putting together plans to go after that. So I think it can be kind of useful. It gets, again, a little ridiculous when they pop on and off of that list, but I take it, I guess what I'm saying is I take it as not a good, you don't want your county to be on that watch list, but it's kind of reassuring to know that there is that sort of backstop.
So I've also seen that counties are putting the brakes, as they have been for the last week, on moving forward with reopening.
Right.
Are you hearing any whispers that there actually might be reinstitutions of previous restrictions as well?
Well, I mean, in theory, I mean, that's technically what's happening. You know, we're shutting down bars. That certainly is a reinstituting of certain measures. You know, Governor Newsom announced last week that the counties that were on this watch list for a period of time would have to, you know, shut down bars, shut down indoor restaurants, sort of move back on that reopening. I think the hope is, and again, you know, kind of hate using his metaphor, the dimmer switch, but the hope is that that's what they're doing, right? That they're adjusting that dimmer switch and kind of reeling back. You know, and then there have been, you know, the conversations around Imperial County, which is in real trouble, just issuing a blanket shelter in place. I think there certainly is possibility of that happening county to county, or maybe even a little bit narrower than that in certain cases. I don't really see a statewide shelter in place, you know, coming from any of this, like coming back at us. But, you know, as Peter well knows, we've been wrong in the past. So, you know, what do I know? Like, this thing is so dynamic. It changes all the time. I'm not hearing any hints of that. I know that the governor wants to avoid that at all costs. So I don't see that happening, but, you know, no guarantees.
So, Peter, what's your advice to listeners at this point in this surge that we're in? Is it the same as a few weeks ago? Are there any nuances to it?
I mean, I love what Aaron was saying about, you know, the feeling that we were all given permission, because I felt that myself. You know, I was angling to go to wine country and, like, you know, I was eyeing these outdoor restaurants, although I didn't, you know, I must confess I didn't go into one myself, but it was tempting. You know, I felt the temptation. I felt that, you know, Dad said it was okay to go out. And now that I think, you know, I feel like we all feel that graveness now in California and certainly in the Bay Area. So in terms of advice, I would say, you know, some of the old advice we had early on probably still applies, which is, like, how do you stay well and occupy your mind when you don't have the activities that you want to have? You know, you do a bunch of different activities. You still try to stay connected with people. And it doesn't mean you invite your class over or have a class reunion, but you still can do one or two, and you do stuff in the outdoors. You know, I would say emphasize the three W's again, you know, wearing a mask, washing your hands, and watching your distance. Because, and of all those things, masks have been so polarizing in our community. But I see more people wearing them in the Bay Area, which is great. So I would remind people to keep your eyes on the prize and wear the mask.
And I just want to shift gears just a little bit, because you've been, it's been on your mind, I know, because you've been tweeting about it quite a bit, which is the rise in, wow, that's very telling.
Is that like a special effect that you
A special had? Effect there. About what I'm about to say, which is the rise in hate crimes against Asian yeah. Americans and Pacific Islanders. More than 2,100 anti-Asian American hate crimes reported between March and June. Tell us how this is affecting you and what you...
I mean, it's affecting me very personally, not only in people I know really well, but even in people like I never thought of it. So I asked my janitor the other day, who I know for a long time, you know, and people don't talk about this, it's an underreporting. I asked her, so have you had any, someone said anything wrong to you about having COVID or thinking it came from China? And I was surprised. She said, yes, she stopped taking the bus because people were saying things to her, and she wouldn't have said that otherwise. And she had a son dropping off to work. So I think these are real. These are underreporting instances. Sometimes they're very violent. And what my advice to people are is to be an upstander when you see this happening, safely, of course. You know, we've tried to arm the community with science and facts, and don't use terms like Chinese virus or Kung Flu virus.
Well, I want to thank you, Peter Chin Hong, for all that you've been doing, both on social media to keep people informed and connected to the science, and also on the wards and in the ICU to keep people healthy or get them back to health. So thanks for being there and for being here with us.
My pleasure, Prashi.
And thanks to you again, Aaron Alday. We look forward to hearing about the latest developments over the next several days next Monday.
Thanks again. Thank you, Peter. Good to see you guys.
Thanks, Aaron. I always learn so much from you.
Same.
And next up, we continue our look at the fight for racial justice here in the Bay Area. Stay with us. This is City Visions. This is Joseph Pache, and this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. 6 weeks ago, George Floyd was murdered at the hands of Minneapolis police, and protests have continued since then. Tonight, we focus on how local officials are responding to the call to address systemic racism in the Bay Area. San Francisco Supervisor Shimon Walton of District 10 has amassed a lot of support from San Francisco's power structure to address several of his initiatives to try to address systemic racism and police brutality here in San Francisco. Some of his proposals have been backed by Mayor Breed, District Attorney Chesa Boudin, and his colleagues on the Board of Supervisors. Walton's Chief of Staff, Natalie G, joins me now to provide a brief rundown of these initiatives. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you, Joseph. Before we begin, I want to take a moment for Jace Young, a six-year-old resident in our district that was tragically shot to death on Sunday. And so a lot of our work, we've been working on a lot of violence prevention, but this is a tragedy that shouldn't happen to anyone. This was one of two homicides that happened this weekend. We had another homicide yesterday with an 18-year-old. So our office is definitely, we have very heavy hearts right now.
And thank you for coming on at this time, because I know Supervisor Walton was going to be on the show tonight, but because he is in the community, in his district, attending a vigil, he wasn't able to be here. So thank you for stepping in.
Of course.
So in this period of political protests and agitation and upheaval and calls for racial justice, Supervisor Walton has put on the table several initiatives to try to address some of the systemic problems that have plagued the African American community here in San Francisco when it comes to police brutality. Tell us a little bit more about them.
Sure. Last month, we introduced several pieces of legislation around equity and racial justice. The first one was with District Attorney Chesa Bodine, with the unanimous support of the Board of Supervisors to require that the Civil Service Commission adopt policies that would prevent hiring officers or sheriff deputies with prior misconduct. This resolution was passed on June 23rd, and we are currently working with the Civil Service Commission to implement that policy. The second piece is we are working with Mayor London Breed and the Human Rights Commission to conduct a series of community meetings through Zoom to redirect SFPD resources into the Black community. And there's been just decades of disinvestment, public policies, institutional practices in San Francisco that have all disproportionately harmed all aspects of life, including health, wellness, mortality, housing, education, and economic opportunities in the Black community. So in these times of continued systemic and systematic oppression of Black people, we have to be innovative and strong with our solutions. So one way is to redirect resources from the San Francisco Police Department back into the community. And SFPD just has, they have a $700 million plus budget. This is a lot higher than what they had a few years ago too.
And so what's the what's this process going to look like, and how much money is going to be moved from the police to directly impact and improve the lived experience of African Americans in our city?
Well, we are working with the Human Rights Commission to conduct the community meetings to see where the community wants to input that money. The Board of Supervisors is also going through a budget process right now. So on Wednesday, there will be a budget committee and a hearing on the SFPD budget where the supervisors will discuss how that budget should be.
I'm hearing numbers wide ranging from $25 million to $100 million. Is that what you're hearing? Is that per year or is it a one-time thing?
I think those are still in discussion. With the mayor, I think they might have said 15% or 10% of the budget. So it's around, there's a good range on it.
And so there's a couple of other initiatives that I want to make sure we get to as well. The one providing or creating a new structure to provide oversight over the Sheriff's Department. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So this work actually started when we first came into office last year, and there were incidents of just misconduct in the Sheriff's Department where sheriffs would have, fights or have inmates fight each other and bet on them. And so there wasn't oversight at that time. We were working with the late Jeff Adachi, our late public defender, in creating this legislation that would create an oversight board as well as an inspector general to be able to hold the sheriff's department accountable.
And my understanding is that the sheriff's department already has an agreement with the police department and the Department of Police Accountability to do that very thing for the sheriff's department. Why are you and specifically Supervisor Walton asking for it to be a separate body that polices the sheriff, so to speak?
Well, the Department of Police Accountability really just focuses on SFPD and their accountability, not so much on the sheriff. And they already have a lot of work and not enough capacity to be able to oversee another department.
And then just to round out a couple more things here before you go, making 911 race-based calls illegal. Tell us more about that, and why is this different than perhaps making false claims when one calls 911 already?
Yeah. Well, actually, we are planning to introduce this legislation tomorrow, so I'm actually very excited about it. But as you can see, even on social media, there's been higher incidents of people calling 911 on people of color for simply doing daily activities. And even in San Francisco, there was a white couple who called the police on a Filipino man for just stenciling Black Lives Matter in Pacific Heights. So when law enforcement responds to non-emergency calls as a result of the caller's racism and racial bias, it diverts resources away from actual emergencies to the unnecessary policing of people of color. So we work with the city attorneys to craft this legislation, and also Assembly Member Rob Bonta of Oakland is doing a similar legislation on the state level. So this will be a statewide thing to prohibit folks from dialing 911 on the basis of somebody's race, ethnicity, religious affiliation, gender, sexual orientation, or gender identity.
And is this something different than making false claims in when one calls 911? How is this going to be different?
It's a little bit similar, but I think we wanted to outline specifically on race, since this has been a issue that's been happening a lot in our communities.
And finally, Supervisor Walton has made a declaration calling for a war on racism. Mm-hmm. I know this is quite a lot to talk about, and it'd be great to have him on the show at some point to have him say more. But in a few words, can you tell us what he means by that and what he's hoping to achieve?
Yes. So we have a resolution declaring war on racism, and it's really to have San Francisco commit to dedicating resources towards combating racism in all its forms, in education, in employment, pay practices, housing, criminalization, and justice reform. It urges the city and county of San Francisco to be guided by the principle that all people are created equal, and we will keep combating racism at the forefront of all our decisions. Along with this resolution, we also have a resolution declaring anti-Black racism as a human rights and public health crisis in San Francisco. And this was initiated by the Human Rights Commission, and we are pushing this through committee very soon.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Natalie G. You're our chief of staff for District 10 Supervisor Shimon Walton. And thanks for outlining his initiatives to help dismantle systemic racism here in San Francisco. We hope to hear more from him in the coming weeks as how this is taking shape.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so next I turn to San Francisco Chronicle columnist Otis R. Taylor Jr. and Mission Local's managing editor Joe Eskenazi for a response. They've both been covering the protests of how our public institutions have been responding for the call for racial justice. Otis and Joe, it's my pleasure to welcome you both back to City Visions.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And welcome, Joe. I believe your mic is still muted. There you go.
Very much so.
So, Joe, let me start with you. Just commenting on the initiatives that we just discussed in brief regarding Supervisor Shimon Walton's initiatives to really root out systemic racism from some of the institutions of San Francisco government. What do you make of this raft of initiatives?
Well, it's about time. It's about time. And I think it's worth getting the work started to see what can be accomplished quickly and if not easily, straightforwardly, and what cannot. I don't know if Natalie addressed this because I was having computer problems of my own, but in obtaining the records of problem police officers, that looks to be a big challenge, even for members of the government. Those records are hard to get in the state of California, thanks to the Police Officers' Bill of Rights. And what's more, as everyone is aware, the police are often granted a great degree of leniency in their punishments. And so somebody who committed behavior that we might think is abhorrent wouldn't qualify as someone who committed misconduct and therefore wouldn't be flagged for this kind of lateral hire. An example is the officer who recently is the subject of an $180,000 settlement in San Francisco who shot a fleeing suspect in North Beach in his prior post in South City. He killed a boy and he was exonerated. And that would not have shown up with a law like this. So I'm very interested by all the things that Supervisor Walton is doing, but in many ways it's testing how broken the system is in seeing what we can accomplish here.
And what are you hearing from the offices of the other politicians who seem to be supporting Supervisor Walton, that being D.A. Chesa Boudin, or Mayor Breed herself, or San Francisco's police chief, William Scott. How are they participating in this process?
If anybody has any complaints, they're not saying it out loud. And I think that any complaint would quickly be met by the rejoinder of, you waited too long and now we're going to do it this way. So I think that specifics is the thing that we all want now. I think even Supervisor Walton's office would like some specifics, probably from the mayor's office, with regard to the budget amount and how and where it will go. Money is going to be very scarce. The fiscal year just started and things are going to get a whole lot worse. So it will be great to see how much of the money that may or may not be taken from the police will go to the Black community needs that everyone's talking about here, and how much just has to go to keep the lights running.
And what numbers are you hearing?
Well, the numbers have been pretty scarce. Supervisor Walton had told me initially that he wanted to see at least $25 million. Anything less than that, he thought would be kind of a paltry effort. But then when he saw how much money was coming out of the police department, theoretically, he said that $100 million is he described that as how much there is to work with. When I asked him if that would be a sufficient number, he said, there's no number that's sufficient. And that's a very deep thing to say, I think. And I took him at his word.
And I imagine this is per year at this point, or is this going to be decided?
Yes. This is per year until otherwise. I mean, it's not a one-time thing. You can't have a one-time grant to end systemic racism, I don't think.
Not that I was thinking that either. I was thinking more mm-hmm. about like how future thinking are legislators at this point. Are they just saying that this is something that we're just going to put in automatically, or it has to be renewed every year, or that kind of thing?
That's a good question. I didn't think you thought that, by the way. But after a while, you might not take the money out of the police budget. You might just have that money go to these causes directly and budget the police less. You know, mm-hmm. at times, you know, you might come up with a more efficient system for that. And, you know, I think inherent in this is rethinking what the police do and what the police don't do, and what you need someone with a gun and a badge and qualified immunity to do, and what you don't need him to do or her to do.
And there's a point that was made a couple of times by Natalie G, the chief of staff of Supervisor Walton, that the community is going to get involved in deciding where this money goes and how it's used. What are you hearing about those efforts? I imagine that that's easy to say, but hard to do. And who knows what that process is going to actually turn out to look like. But what are you seeing initially here?
I mean, I think that that Supervisor Walton's office and the mayor's office are rolling this one out. And I think that they are going to do their due diligence and poll the community needs. But, you know, when you're talking about redistributing hundreds of millions of dollars, that is a process that without good organization could become very messy and disastrous. So I'm sure that they're planning this really well before they take this to the people for a plebiscite. And I would imagine that, you know, it's going to be a very organized process.
So you brought up the next point, which is that San Francisco voters have a lot to work to do here and a lot to contribute to this process. Tell us why that is.
In San Francisco, you must vote on everything. And in San Francisco, in order to meaningfully defund the police, whatever that means, and I think most people at this point in time believe it means, you know, paying them less to do less, and no disrespect intended. You can't really do that until there are some major structural changes within the police department, and that will require a changing of the charter, and that requires a vote.
And my understanding from reading some of your reporting is that this can't necessarily be up for voters until 2022. That feels a long time away.
It not necessarily. It could be on November's ballot, depending upon whether Supervisor Norman Yee moves ahead or doesn't move ahead. And we're seeing some kind of forces come to fruition here where frustration within the city at meeting and conferring and slowing down the process with the police union, which is not seen as a willing partner in police reform at this point in time, has kind of the dam is broken there. Supervisor Norman Yee, from my reporting, I believe is inclined to move forward. He's met and conferred. They've had their discussion. They may not agree, but they've met and conferred. And then last week, the police commission decided it would not meet and confer with the police officers union on a new use of force policy. And there is case law about this. The police union sued us and lost in 2017 and lost on appeal in 2018 about what you can meet and confer on and what you don't need to, what the city doesn't have to grant them that wish. And of course, that slows down the process. And with regard to Norman Yee, if he misses the deadline to submit the charter amendment, it doesn't get on the ballot until 2022, as you mentioned. And that charter amendment, among other things, could allow the reduction in size of the police force, which doesn't necessarily have to mean laying anyone off. It also could mean that you just don't hire when people retire, et cetera, or those jobs are done by other, not police. But, you know, this is, you're not going to get the discussion started until we reduce our, until we don't have a charter minimum. Doesn't mean you're going to let people go. It just means that's a possibility.
And the police union seems to be coming to the table when it's being asked.
Well, the police union would like to meet and confer on this. And the police union is adamant against this charter amendment, as any union would be, because it gets rid of a minimum staffing requirement.
Okay, so we'll see how this plays out as the months unfold. I want to turn next to Otis Taylor, who's joining us from the San Francisco Chronicle. Otis, Oakland just removed $14 million from the police budget. Tell us what happened there, what the process was like, and what the reaction is.
Well, let's start with the reaction. It's not enough. I mean, we're talking about centuries of systemic racism, and you know, removing $14 million from police budget, that's not going to do anything. We need a more concerted effort from our city officials, and actually state and federal officials as well, to really address the problems that exist within police departments and structurally and institutionally in this country. This came about, though, I want to make this clear. This came about because people were and continue to be in the streets. Without mass organization, this would not have happened. It took a man dying on camera and that going across social media for people to get into the streets. And then that caused city officials, at least in Oakland, I know San Francisco officials have done, begun talking about how they can address this through policy. But I find that in Oakland, it was, you know, it's still, as Joe mentioned, the unions, they don't want any part of this because it reduces the minimum staffing that is required. But I think if you look at some of the discussions that were happening in Oakland City Hall at the time, there are some folks who think that we could do without the police. And there are some folks who think that we have to have a minimum number of officers to police our streets. But I want to make this clear, like, police do not actually address crime reduction. That is policy that does that.
And policy that improves educational and job opportunities and access to healthcare and wealth accumulation, I presume.
Oh, of course. Well, you take a look at this. There's a relationship that can be found through data that if you grow up in an environment that where you are immersed in poverty, that's what your parents knew, and your parents before that. And this area has no resources, no grocery stores, no resources as far as like community development. I mean, we're talking about Oakland and West Oakland. It just opened its first grocery store in 4 decades last year. 4 decades. And guess who lived in Oakland during that time? Black and brown people. Guess who's moving to that part of Oakland right now? White people. So it's that kind of thing that needs to be realized that, okay, well, Brookings Institution released a study earlier this year that found that since the last recession, that people who live in poor neighborhoods had a higher rate of crime, because they didn't have things like job opportunities. Their social networks weren't able to lift them up like, say, yours or mine could if I was looking for a job. And it's about this Oakland is at this point right now where the mothers, Moms for Housing, moved in the house. And it was about this issue we're about to get into in a couple months. If people are evicted from their homes, it's just that, you know, you create an environment where the people who have long lived there aren't able to afford to live there anymore. And so you have cities like Oakland, San Francisco before it, that have made these strides, but the people that live there, Black and brown people specifically, weren't able to benefit from the changes. And we're seeing that all over Oakland right now. And so that's why I think policy needs to be, keep that in mind.
And so how much can $14 million get you towards those types of policies? And what would you prioritize with that amount? And then, and what's the process to get that number to go up?
Exactly. So I can't speak to the process. It needs political will. It's always needed political will. But here's the thing about Oakland, which I am hopeful about. So Oakland founded, I think, 2016, the Department of Race and Equity. So there's a woman, Darlene Flynn, who heads that department, who is trying to make Oakland policymakers, and not just, you know, it's city council, but city staff, to make decisions with an equity lens. Here's an example. Last year, the Oakland Department of Transportation wanted to focus a majority of its repaving plan in Black and brown neighborhoods that have been historically under-resourced. Of course, people in Oakland Hills got upset about it. But the point is that Oakland didn't back down, and the plan is still going accordingly. It is giving these neighborhoods that have long been had these potholes, these terrible roads. And if you think about it, these are the neighborhoods where people who are still having to go to work. They're not working in a house because that is a privilege. It's going to take more of that. But as I talked to when I talked to Darlene Flynn recently, she told me, you know, her fear is that if we do enter a long recession, that that will push equity by the wayside. And we won't be thinking about that. We'll just be trying to keep the lights on. I think it needs people to continue to pressure officials to do more, because historically what has happened is people have done just enough to satiate folks. And I really don't think that's going to happen this time.
So, and why did it fall short this time?
Well, it's just $14 million. I mean, we're talking about.
No, I know that. I mean, but why wasn't it a higher number? I think is what I meant.
There. Oh, because you have a lot of power in police unions. I mean, they operate on this idea of fear that if I'm not there, crime is going to get out of control, which to me is incongruous because you're already saying crime's out of control because – and you have this many officers. And so the fear of losing officers is put forth, and people subscribe to that. But the thing is, officers aren't actually reducing crime. And frankly, officers aren't solving crimes at a rate where it's acceptable. I mean, in Oakland, we have crews, stick-up crews, just rolling around the city, unabated, snatching purses. Like, why aren't we looking at that? And I mean, I've gone toe-to-toe with OPD about that. It's like you will occupy these neighborhoods and arrest people for low-level infractions, but then, you know, you've got crews that you know of roaming the streets. It's you can't have it both ways with policing. And I would really appreciate if the discussion more is on, like, how is policing actually reducing crime? How is policing actually improving neighborhood statistics, outcomes? How are they actually helping? And don't give me midnight basketball with a cop. That's not good enough. I mean, we need to cut all of that out and focus on how do we get some of that money back into the community instead of paying people to arrest people in that community for essentially being poor.
I want to turn to something that's happening next week. You're going to be hosting a virtual roundtable with on the 15th of July with some local youth leaders around this protest movement that has sustained energy now for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what you have been hearing from youth leaders and other youth protesters and what you hope to see happen that could really push to create the political will that you hope will materialize such that next time around, it won't be $14 million that is set aside for African-American and Black community development.
Oh, sure, sure. So what I've seen is that a lot of the organization is being done by young people. And when I'm talking about teenagers, early 20s, and that's really what that discussion is about, is to give voice or further amplify these voices that have been instrumental in organizing, the organizing that has caused cities to react, but also to talk about why they're in the streets and they're continuing to organize and what do they want to see.
And what message are they putting out there that perhaps we haven't heard before?
Well, that's the thing. We've heard the message before. I mean, end racism. I mean, let's just start there. But what I think these younger people are, at least right now here in the Bay, they are able through social media to get more folks, more white people, more young white people out to the street. I think that is what's different right now, is that you have a bigger representation from white people who acknowledge their privilege in the space and want to be part of the solution instead of deflecting and dismissing and denying. That's what's different with this youth movement.
How can people join that youth roundtable?
I think if you go to if you go to the Chronicle, I always want to promote the Chronicle, but if you go to the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive, and that's BAMFA.org, BAMPFA.org, and you'll have all the information there. And I welcome the conversation because I feel that I'm learning too, and it's all about dialogue, and I'm committed to continuing this dialogue so we don't just recede after so much progress is being made in the last 2 months and then recede once we start worrying about the recession.
Thanks so much, Otis Taylor. Perhaps we'll have you back with some of those youth leaders in the future. So thanks to Otis Taylor and Joe Eskenazi for your comments. And we'll hope to speak again soon as these initiatives take more shape. Stay with us. Coming up, we're joined by Bay Area jazz singer Paula West.
Was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far over land.
Paula West joins me now. The Jazz Times called her the finest jazz cabaret singer around. Paula's performances over the years at Feinstein's, at the Nico, SF Jazz, and Dizzy's in New York, among other venues, have earned her an enthusiastic and devoted following. She pushes the boundaries of traditional jazz standards with an eclectic mix of songs rendered in her powerful contralto voice. And you just heard Paula's performance of Nature Boy, and we are delighted that Paula has joined us here tonight. I'd like to welcome you, Paula West, to City Visions.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
I've been enjoying the whole program.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad to hear that. So it's an accomplishment to be deemed the finest jazz cabaret singer around. Did you always want to be a singer?
No, I didn't know what I wanted to be for a very long time. When I finished school, I just kind of, I was waiting tables and saving money to go back and forth to Europe, and stuff. But I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I was never in choir and stuff. I played clarinet, and I've always loved music, but I thought, maybe I can, sing once or twice a year, for a little hobby thing. And then I actually found a passion. So it turned out to be more than what I expected.
And
still does.
and your repertoire is quite broad. You have Cole Porter in there, Bob Dylan. How do you go about choosing the songs you decide to perform?
Well, when I first started, it was definitely what we would call the traditional American songbook. As you said, Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin. But, you know, the songbook has expanded because Bob Dylan and Hank Williams and these people, they're over, you know, 50, 60 years old now. So they're classics, well-done tunes. I'm definitely drawn to the lyrics. And Bob Dylan's my favorite, though, I have to say. I have discovered Bob Dylan is my absolute favorite. And it seems to be a favorite of the audiences also.
Just about a month ago, you had a live Facebook concert, a live concert on Facebook. No audience, yes. Unfortunately, in the room with you. One of the pieces you chose to sing was the 1929 piece, Black and Blue, composed by Fats Waller.
Andy Razzle.
That's right. And Harry Brooks, also the lyricist there as well. The complete title is What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue? And its lyrics seem to crystallize the experience of exclusion and dehumanization of Blacks and African Americans in this country.
Yes.
What was it like for you to sing that song at this moment?
Well, you know, I've done that song. First time I did that song was probably about 15 years ago. And it still resonates. It always has. The struggle, what we have to go through being Black. And it's, of course, with Black Lives Matter. And particularly this year, you know, I wasn't expecting to do that song during the concert. But I decided to add it. Only, you know, came up with the song list like 3 days before of what we were going to do. And we didn't even get to some of the songs. But I've done a politics and protest show through SF Jazz and SF Performances. But I didn't have Black and Blue in either of those programs at the time. And it just, it was time to bring it out again.
And how was it different, if at all, this time around?
Well, it's very emotional. Sometimes I feel like my, you know, voice chokes up at certain points. That could happen. But it was just time to do it again. You know, it just happens like that. Sometimes it's just time to do, you know, certain tunes. We also had visual slides showing, you know, everything from Emmett Till to the modern, to the present day protesting that has been going on. And I'm so proud of what has happened and what is, you know, what is going on now with, I guess I have to call them younger people now, with what's going on, what is happening, and what we have a movement. And I don't think it's just a trend.
Well, where can people listen to you next?
They can, if they can still go see the concert that we did. It was at Ken Folk's beautiful St. Joseph's Art Society. And he was, you know, so kind to lend us a space. It's like 22,000 square feet. So we had plenty of room to distance ourselves. And there weren't 10 people in the room. But they can look at that on the paula-west.com website. And I'm not sure what's going to happen next. I'd like to start recording another CD and then do a big concert like that. I don't think performance spaces are going to be opened up.
Well, we'll go ahead and point our listeners to your website so they can listen to your wonderful voice. And in fact, we're going to close out the show with another of your pieces. Thanks so much, Paula West.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And this is Joseph Pache. This was City Visions. Thanks to Damian Miner, Wendy Holcomb, and Chris Nooney. We'll see you again next week. And let's close it out with more of Paula West. Good night.
Whoa. once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the buns a dime in your prime, didn't you? People call said beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all getting you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't.
Thank you for listening to KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM.